Track 9.
In the northwestern corner of the Caribbean basin, there is an area of shallow warm water, hemmed in on one side by the island chain of the Great Antilles, the bulwark of Cuba and Hispaniola, while in the west, the sweep of the Yucatan Peninsula runs south through Panama into the great landmass of South America. Shallow, warm, trapped water and saturated tropical air, enclosed by landmasses which can heat very rapidly in the high, hot sun of the tropics. However, all of it is gently cooled and moderated by the benign influence of the northeasterly trade winds. Winds so unvarying in strength and direction that over the centuries, seafaring men have placed their lives and their fortunes at risk upon their balmy wings, gambling on the constancy of that vast moving body of mild air. But the wind does fail. For no apparent reason, without previous warning, it dies away, often merely for an hour or two, but occasionally, very occasionally, for days or weeks at a time. Far to the south and east of this devil's spawning ground, the golden dawn ploughed massively on through the sweltering air and silken calm of the doldrums, northwards across the equator, changing course every few hours to maintain the great circle track that would carry her well clear of that glittering shield of islands that the Caribbean carries like an armoured knight on its shoulder. The treacherous channels and passages through the islands were not for a vessel of Golden Dawn's immense bulk, deep draft, and limited manoeuvrability. She was to go high above the Tropic of Cancer, and just south of the island of Bermuda, she would make her westings and enter the wider and safer waters of the Florida Straits above Grand Bahamas. On this course, she would be constricted by narrow and shallow seaways for only a few hundred miles before she was out into the open waters of the Gulf of Mexico again. But while she ran on northwards, out of the area of equatorial calm, she should have come out at last into the sweet, cool airs of the trades. But she did not. Day after day, the calm persisted, and stifling still air pressed down on the ship. It did not in any way slow or affect her passage, but her master remarked to Duncan Alexander, "Another corker today, by the looks of it." When he received no reply from his brooding, silent chairman, he retired discreetly, leaving Duncan alone on the open wing of the bridge, with only the breeze of the ship's passage ruffling his thick, coppery hair. However, the calm was not merely local. It extended westwards in a wide, hot belt across the thousand islands and the basin of shallow sea they enclosed. The calm lay heavily on the oily waters, and the sun beat down on the enclosing land masses. Every hour the air heated and sucked up the evaporating waters. A fat bubble, like a swelling blister, began to rise, the first movement of air in many days. It was not a big bubble, only 100 miles across, but as it rose, the rotation of the earth's surface began to twist the rising air, spinning it like a top, so that the satellite cameras, hundreds of miles above, recorded a creamy little spiral wisp like the decorative icing flower on a wedding cake. The cameras relayed the picture through many channels, until at last it reached the desk of the senior forecaster of the Hurricane Watch at the meteorological headquarters at Miami in southern Florida. "Looks like a ripe one," he grunted to his assistant, recognizing that all the favorable conditions for the formation of a revolving tropical storm were present. "We'll ask Air Force for a fly-through." At 45,000 feet, the pilot of the U.S. Air Force B-52 saw the rising dome of the storm from 200 miles away. It had grown enormously in only 6 hours. As the warm, saturated air was forced upwards, so the icy cold of the upper troposphere condensed the water vapor into thick, puffed-up silver clouds. They boiled upwards, roiling and swirling upon themselves. Already the dome of cloud and ferociously turbulent air was higher than the aircraft. Under it, a partial vacuum was formed, and the surrounding surface air tried to move in to fill it. But it was compelled into an anti-clockwise track around the center by the mysterious forces of the Earth's rotation. Compelled to travel the long route, the velocity of the air mass accelerated ferociously, and the entire system became more unstable, more dangerous by the hour, turning faster, perpetuating itself by creating greater wind velocities and steeper pressure gradients. The cloud at the top of the enormous rising dome reached an altitude where the temperature was 30 degrees below freezing. The droplets of rain turned to crystals of ice and were smeared away by upper-level jet streams. Long, beautiful patterns of cirrus against the high blue sky were blown hundreds of miles ahead of the storm to serve as its heralds. The U.S. Air Force B-52 hit the first clear air turbulence 150 miles from the storm center. It was as though an invisible predator had seized the fuselage and shaken it until the wings were almost torn from their roots, and in one surge, the aircraft was flung 5,000 feet straight upwards. "Very severe turbulence," the pilot reported. "We have vertical wind speeds of 300 miles an hour plus." The senior forecaster in Miami picked up the telephone and called the computer programmer on the floor above him. "Ask Charlie for a hurricane code name." And a minute later, the programmer called him back. "Charlie says to call the bitch Lorner." 600 miles southwest of Miami, the storm began to move forward, slowly at first, but every hour gathering power, spiraling upon itself at unbelievable velocities, its high dome swelling upwards now through 50,000 feet and still climbing. The center of the storm opened like a flower. The calm eye extended upwards in a vertical tunnel, with smooth walls of solid cloud rising to the very summit of the dome, now 60,000 feet above the surface of the wind-tortured sea. The entire mass began to move faster, back towards the east, in a directly contrary direction to the usual track of the gentle trade winds. Spinning and roaring upon itself, devouring everything in its path, the she-devil called Lorna launched itself across the Caribbean Sea. Nicholas Berg turned his head to look down upon the impressive skyline of Miami Beach. The rampart of tall, elegant hotel buildings followed the curve of the beach into the north, and behind it lay the ugly, sprawled tangle of urban development and snarled highways. The Eastern Airlines direct flight from Bermuda turned on to its base leg and then on to final approach, losing height over the beach and Biscayne Bay. Nicholas felt uncomfortable, the nagging of guilt and uncertainty. His guilt was of two kinds. He felt guilty that he deserted his post at the moment when he was likely to be desperately needed. Ocean Salvage's two vessels were out there somewhere in the Atlantic. Warlock running hard up the length of the Atlantic in a desperate attempt to catch up with Golden Dawn, while Jules Le Voisin in Sea Witch was now approaching the eastern seaboard of America, where he would refuel before going on to his assignment as standby tug on the exploration field in the Gulf of Mexico. At any moment, the master of either vessel might urgently need to have his instructions. Then there was Golden Dawn. She had rounded the Cape of Good Hope almost 3 weeks ago. Since then, even Bernard Wacky had been unable to fix her position. She had not been reported by other craft, and any communications she had made with Christy Main must have been by satellite telex, for she had maintained strict silence on the radio channels. However, she must rapidly be nearing the most critical part of her voyage when she turned west and began her approach to the continental shelf of North America and the passage of the islands into the Gulf. Peter Berg was on board that monster, and Nicholas felt the chill of guilt. His place was at the center, in the control room of Bach Wacky, on the top floor of the Bank of Bermuda building in Hamilton Town. His post was there, where he could assess changing conditions and issue instant commands to coordinate his salvage tugs. Now he had deserted his post, and even though he had made arrangements to maintain contact with Bernard Wacky, still it would take him hours, perhaps even days, to get back to where he was needed if there were an emergency. But then there was Samantha. His instincts warned him that every day, every hour he delayed in going to her, would reduce his chances of having her again. There was more guilt there, the guilt of betrayal. It was no help to tell himself that he had no marriage vows to Samantha Silver, that his night of weakness with Chantel had been forced upon him in circumstances almost impossible to resist, that any other man in his position would have done the same, and that in the end the episode had been a catharsis and a release that had left him free forever of Chantel. To Samantha, it had been betrayal, and he knew that much was destroyed by it. He felt terrible aching guilt, not for the act. The sexual intercourse without love is fleeting and insignificant, but for the betrayal and for the damage he had wrought. Now he was uncertain as to just how much he had destroyed, how much was left for him to build upon. All that he was certain of was that he needed her, more than he needed anything in his life. She was still the promise of eternal youth and of the new life towards which he was groping so uncertainly. If love was needing, then he loved Samantha Silver with something close to desperation. She had told him she would not be there when he came. He had to hope now that she had lied. He felt physically sick at the thought that she meant it. He had only a single Louis Vuitton overnight valise as cabin luggage, so he passed swiftly through customs. As he went into the telephone booths, he checked his watch. It was after 6 o'clock. She'd be home by now. He had dialed the first 4 digits of her number before he checked himself. "What the hell am I phoning for?" he asked himself grimly. "To tell her I'm here, so she can have a flying start when she runs for the bushes?" There is nothing so doomed as a timid lover. He dropped the receiver back on its cradle and went to the Hertz desk at the terminal doors. "What's the smallest you've got?" he asked. "A cougar," the pretty blonde in the yellow uniform told him. In America, small is a relative term. He was just lucky she hadn't offered him a Sherman tank. The brightly painted Chevy van was in the lean-to shelter under the spread branches of the ficus tree, and he parked the cougar's nose almost touching its tailgate. There was no way she could escape now, unless she went out through the far wall of the shed. Knowing her, there was always a possibility. He grinned mirthlessly. He knocked once on the screen door of the kitchen and went straight on in. There was a coffee pot beside the range, and he touched it as he passed. It was still warm. He went through into the living room and called, "Samantha." The bedroom door was ajar. He pushed it open. There was a suit of denims and some pale, transparent wisps of underwear thrown carelessly over the patchwork quilt. The shack was deserted. He went down the steps of the front stoop and straight onto the beach. The tide had swept the sand smooth, and her prints were the only ones. She had dropped her towel above the high water mark, but he had to shade his eyes against the ruddy glare of the lowering sun before he could make out her bobbing head, 500 yards out. He sat down beside her towel in the fluffy dry sand and lit a cheroot. He waited while the sun settled in a wild, fiery flood of light, and he lost the shape of her head against the darkening sea. She was half a mile out now, but he felt no urgency, and the darkness was almost complete when she rose suddenly, waist deep from the edge of the gentle surf, waded ashore, and came up the beach, twisting the rope of her hair over one shoulder to wring the water from it. Nicholas felt his heart flop over, and he flicked the cheroot away and stood up. She halted abruptly, like a startled forest animal, and stood completely still, staring uncertainly at the tall, dark figure before her. She was so young and slim and smooth and beautiful. "What do you want?" she faltered. "You," he said. "Why? Are you starting a harem?" Her voice hardened, and she straightened. He could not see the expression of her eyes, but her shoulders took on a stubborn set. He stepped forward, and she was rigid in his arms, and her lips hard and tightly unresponsive under his. "Sam, there are things I'll never be able to explain. I don't even understand them myself. But what I do know very clearly is that I love you, that without you, my life is going to be flat and plain goddamn miserable." There was no relaxation of the rigid muscles. Her hands were still held stiffly at her sides, and her body felt cold and wet and unyielding. "Samantha, I wish I were perfect. I'm not. But all I am sure of is that I can't make it without you. I couldn't take it again. I couldn't live through this again," she said tightly. "I need you. I'm certain of that," he insisted. "You'd better be, you son of a bitch. You cheat on me one time more, and you won't have anything left to cheat with. I'll take it off clean, at the roots." Then she was clinging to him. "Oh, God, Nicholas, how I hated you, and how I missed you, and how long you took to come back." And her lips were soft and tasted of the sea. He picked her up and carried her up through the soft sand. He didn't trust himself to speak. It would be so easy to say the wrong thing now. "Nicholas, I've been sitting here waiting for your call." Bernard Wacky's voice was sharp and alert, the tension barely contained. "How soon can you get yourself back here?" "What is it?" "It's starting to pop. I've got to hand it to you, baby. You've got a nose for it. You smelled this coming." "Come on, Bernie," Nicholas snapped. "This call is going through three open exchanges," Bernie told him. "You want chapter and verse, or did nobody ever tell you that it's a tough game you're in? There's a lot of competition cluttering up the scene. The cheeseheads have one lying handy. Probably Vitezee or one of the other big Dutch tugs." Nicholas thought swiftly. "They could be streaming a towing wire within a couple of days. And the Yanks are pretty hot numbers. McCormick has one stationed in the Hudson River." "All right." Nick cut through the relish with which Bernie was detailing the threat of hovering competition. Now there's a direct flight at 7 tomorrow morning. If I can't make that, I'll connect with the British Airways flight from Nassau at noon tomorrow. Meet me, Nick ordered. You shouldn't have gone running off, said Bernard Wacky, showing amazing hindsight. Before he could deliver any more pearls of wisdom, Nicholas hung up on him. Samantha was sitting up in the center of the bed. She was stark naked, but she hugged her knees to her chest with both arms, and under the gorgeous tangle of her hair, her face was desolate as that of a lost child, and her green eyes haunted. "You're going again," she said softly. "You only just came, and now you're going again. Oh, God, Nicholas, loving you is the toughest job I've ever had in my life. I don't think I've got the muscle for it." He reached for her quickly, and she clung to him, pressing her face into the thick pad of coarse dark hair that covered his chest. "I have to go. I think it's golden dawn," he said. And she listened quietly while he told it to her. Only when he finished speaking did she begin to ask the questions which kept them talking quietly, locked in each other's arms in the old brass bed until long after midnight. She insisted on cooking his breakfast for him, even though it was still dark outside, and she was more than half asleep, hanging on to the reins for support and turning up the early morning radio show so that the music might shake her awake. "Good morning, early birds. This is WWOK with another lovely day ahead of you. I predicted 85 degrees at Fort Lauderdale and the coast, and 80 degrees inland with a 10% chance of rain. We've got a report on the Hurricane Lorna for you also. She's dipping away south towards the Lesser Antilles, so we can all relax, folks. Relax and listen to Elton John." "I love Elton John," Samantha said sleepily. "Don't you?" "Who is he?" Nicholas asked. "There. I knew right away we had a lot in common." She blinked at him owlishly. "Did you kiss me good morning?" "I forget." "Come here," he instructed. "You're not going to forget this one." Then, a few minutes later, "Nicholas, you'll miss your plane." "Not if I cut breakfast." It would have been a grotty breakfast anyway. She was coming awake fast now. She gave him the last kiss through the open window of the Cougar. "You've got an hour. You'll just about make it." He started the engine, and still she held onto the sill. "Nicholas, one day, we will be together, I mean all the time, like we planned. You and me doing our own thing our own way. We will, won't we?" "It's a promise." "Hurry back," she said, and he gunned the Cougar up the sandy driveway without looking back. There were eight of them crowded into Tom Parker's office. Although there was seating only for three, the others found perches against the tiered shelves with their rows of biological specimens in bottles of formaldehyde, or on the piles of reference books and white papers that were stacked against the walls. Samantha sat on the corner of Tom's desk, swinging her long, denim-clad legs, and answered the questions that were fired at her. "How do you know she'll take the passage of the Florida Straits?" "It's an educated guess. She's just too big and clumsy to thread the needle of the islands." Samantha's replies were quick. "Nicholas is betting on it." "I'll go along with that, then," Tom grunted. "The straits are 100 miles wide." "I know what you're going to say." Samantha smiled and turned to one of the girls. "Sally Ann will answer that one." "You all know my brother is in the Coast Guard. All traffic through the straits reports to Fort Lauderdale," she explained, "and the Coast Guard aircraft patrol out as far as Grand Bahama. We'll have a fix on her immediately she enters the straits. We've got the whole U.S. Coast Guard rooting for us." They argued and discussed for 10 minutes more before Tom Parker slapped an open palm on the desk in front of him, and they subsided reluctantly into silence. "Okay," he said. "Do I understand the proposal to be that this chapter of Greenpeace intercepts the tanker carrying Catteridge crudes before it enters American territorial waters and attempts to delay or divert the ship. That's exactly it, Samantha nodded, and looked about her for support. They were all nodding and murmuring agreement. What are we trying to achieve? Do we truly believe that we will be able to hold up the delivery of toxic crudes to the refinery at Galveston? Let's define our objectives, Tom insisted. In order for evil men to triumph, it is necessary only that good men do nothing. We are doing something. Bullshit, Sam, Tom growled. Let's cut down on the rhetoric. It's one of the things that does us more harm than good. You talk like a nut, and you discredit yourself before you've begun. All right, Samantha grinned. We are publicizing the dangers and our opposition to them. Okay, Tom nodded. That's better. What are our other objectives? They discussed that for 20 minutes more, and then Tom Parker took over again. Fine. Now, how do we get out there in the straits to confront this vessel? Do we put on our water wings and swim? Even Samantha looked sheepish now. She glanced around for support, while the others were studying their fingernails or gazing with sudden fascination out of the windows. Well, Samantha began, and then hesitated. We thought... Go on, Tom encouraged her. Of course, you weren't thinking of using university property, were you? There is actually a law in this country against taking other people's ships. It's called piracy. As a matter of fact, Samantha gave a helpless shrug, and as a senior and highly respected member of the faculty, you would not expect me to be party to a criminal act. They were all silent, watching Samantha, for she was their leader, but for once she was at a loss. On the other hand, if a party of graduate researchers put in a requisition through the proper channels, I would be quite happy to authorize an extended field expedition across the straits to Grand Bahama on board the Dickey. Tom, you're a darling, said Samantha. That's a hell of a way to speak to your professor, said Tom, and scowled happily at her. They came in on the British Airways flight from Heathrow yesterday afternoon. Three of them. Here is a list of the names. Bernard Wacky slid a notepad across the desk, and Nicholas glanced at it quickly. Charles Gras. I know him. He's chief engineer at Construction Navale Atlantique, Nicholas explained. Right. Bernard nodded. He gave his occupational employer to immigration. Isn't that privileged information? Bernard grinned. I keep my ear to the ground. Then he was deadly serious again. All right. So these three engineers have a small suitcase each and a crate in the hold that weighs 350 kilos, and it's marked industrial machinery. Don't stop now, Nicholas encouraged him. And there is a S-61N Sikorsky helicopter sitting waiting for them on the tarmac. The helicopter has been chartered direct from London by Christie Marine of Leadenhall Street. The three engineers and the case of machinery are shuttled aboard the Sikorsky so fast that it looks like a conjuring trick, and she takes off and egg beats for the south. Did the Sikorsky pilot file a flight plan? Sure did. Service shipping... Course 196 degrees magnetic. ETA to be reported. What's the range of a 61N? 500 nautical miles? Not bad, Bernard conceded. 533 for the standard. But this model has long-range tanks. She's good for 750. But that's one way, not the return journey. The helicopter hasn't returned to Bermuda yet. She could refuel aboard. Or, if they aren't carrying avgas, she could stay on until final destination, Nicholas said. What else have you got? You want more? Bernard looked aghast. Does anything ever satisfy you? Did you monitor the communications between Bermuda Control, the chopper, and the ship she was servicing?
Nix.
Bernard shook his head. There was a box-up. He looked shamefaced. It happens to the best of us.
Oh, spare me the details.
Can you get information from Bermuda Control of the time the chopper closed her flight plan?
Jesus, Nicholas, you know better than that. It's an offense to listen in on the aviation frequencies, let alone ask them.
Nicholas jumped up and crossed swiftly to the Perspex plot. He brooded over it, leaning on clenched fists, his expression smoldering as he studied the large-scale map.
What does all this mean to you, Nicholas?
Bernard came to stand beside him.
It means that a vessel at sea belonging to the Christie Marine Fleet has requested its head office to send machinery spares and specialist personnel by the fastest possible means without regard to expense. Have you figured the air freight on a package of 350 kilos?
Nicholas straightened up and groped for the crocodile skin cheroot case.
It means that the vessel is broken down or in imminent danger of breakdown somewhere in an area southwest of Bermuda, within an arc of 450 miles, probably much closer. Otherwise, she would have requested service from the Bahamas, and it's highly unlikely they would have operated the chopper at extreme range.
Right, Bernard agreed. Nicholas lit his cheroot, and they were both silent a moment.
A hell of a small needle in a bloody big haystack, said Bernard.
You let me worry about that, Nicholas murmured, still without taking his eyes from the plot.
That's what you're paid for,
Bernard agreed amiably.
It's Golden Dawn, isn't it?
Has Christie Marine got any other vessels in the area?
Not as far as I know.
Then that was a bloody stupid question.
Take it easy, Nicholas.
I'm sorry. Nicholas touched his arm. My boy is on that pig. He took a deep draw on the cheroot, held it a moment, and then slowly exhaled. His voice was calm and businesslike as he went on.
What's our weather?
Wind at 060 degrees and 15 knots. Cloud 3/8 at stratocumulus at 4,000 feet. Long-range projection, no change.
Steady trade winds again, Nicholas nodded. Thank God for small mercies.
There's a hurricane warning out, as you know, but on its present position and track, it'll blow itself out to sea 1,000 miles south of Grand Bahama.
Good.
Nicholas nodded again. Please ask both Warlock and Sea Witch to report their positions, course, speed, and fuel conditions.
Bernard had the two telex flimsies for him within 20 minutes.
Warlock has made a good run of it, Nicholas murmured, as the position of the tug was marked on the plot.
She crossed the equator 3 days ago, said Bernard.
And Sea Witch will reach Charleston late tomorrow, Nicholas observed.
Are any of the opposition insiders?
Bernard shook his head.
McCormack had one in New York, and Vitasay is halfway back to Rotterdam.
We are in good shape, Nicholas decided, as he balanced the triangles of relative speeds and distances between the vessels.
Is there another chopper available on the island to get me out to Warlock?
No.
Bernard shook his head. The 61N is the only one based on Bermuda.
Can you arrange bunkering for Warlock? I mean immediate bunkering, here in Hamilton.
We can have her tanks filled an hour after she comes in.
Nicholas paused and then made the decision. Please telex David Allen on Warlock. To Master Warlock from Berg. Immediate and urgent. New speed, top of the green. New course. Hamilton Harbor, Bermuda. Island direct. Report expected time of arrival ends.
You're going to run then?
Bernard asked.
You're going to run with both your ships?
Yes, Nicholas nodded. I'm running with everything I've got. Golden Dawn wallowed with the dead heavy weight of 1 million tons of crude oil. Her motion was that of a waterlogged hulk. Broadside to the set of the swells, her tank decks were almost awash. The low seas broke against her starboard rail, and the occasional crest flopped over and spread like pretty patches of white lacework over the green plastic-coated decks. She had been drifting powerlessly for 4 days now. The main bearing of the single propeller shaft had begun to run hot 48 hours after crossing the equator, and the chief engineer had asked for shutdown to inspect the bearing and effect any repairs. Duncan Alexander had forbidden any shutdown, overriding the good judgment of both his master and chief engineer, and had only grudgingly agreed to a reduction in the ship's speed. He ordered the chief engineer to trace any fault and to effect what repairs he could while under reduced power. Within 4 hours, the chief had traced the damaged and leaking gland in the pump that force lubricated the bearing. But even the running under reduced power setting had done significant damage to the main bearing. And now there was noticeable vibration, jarring even Golden Dawn's massive hull. "I have to get the pump stripped down, or we'll burn her clear out." The chief faced up to Duncan Alexander at last. "Then you'll have to shut down, and not just a couple of hours either. It'll take 2 days to fit new bearing shells at sea." The chief was pale, and his lips trembled, for he knew of this man's reputation. The engineer knew that he discarded those who crossed him, and he had the reputation of a special vindictiveness to hound a man until he was broken. The chief was afraid, but his concern for the ship was just strong enough. Duncan Alexander changed direction. "What was the cause of the pump failure in the first place? Why wasn't it noticed earlier? It looks like a case of negligence to me." Stung at last, the chief blurted out, "If there had been a backup pump on this ship, we could have switched a secondary system and done proper maintenance." Duncan Alexander flushed and turned away. The modifications he had personally ordered to Golden Dawn's design had excluded most of the duplicated backup systems. Anything that kept down the cost of construction had been ordered. "How long do you need?" He stopped in the center of the owner's stateroom and glared at his engineer. 4 hours, the Scot replied promptly. "You've got exactly 4 hours," he said grimly. "If you haven't finished by then, you will live to regret it. I swear that to you." While the engineer stopped his engines, stripped and repaired and reassembled the lubrication pump, Duncan was on the bridge with the master. "We've lost time. Too much time," he said. "I want that made up." "It'll mean pushing over best economic speed," Captain Randall warned carefully. "Captain Randall, the value of our cargo is $85 a ton. We have on board 1 million tons. I want the time made up." Duncan brushed his objection aside. "We have a deadline to meet in Galveston Roads. This ship, this whole concept of carrying crude is on trial, Captain. I don't have to keep reminding you of that. The hell with the costs. I want to meet the deadline." "Yes, Mr. Alexander," Randall nodded. "We'll make up the time." 3.5 hours later, the chief engineer came up to the bridge. "Well?" Duncan turned on him fiercely as he stepped out of the elevator. "The pump is repaired, but..." "What is it, man?" "I've got a feeling we ran her too long. I've got a nasty feeling about that bearing. It wouldn't be clever to run her over 50% of power, not until it's been taken down and inspected." "I'm ordering revolutions for 25 knots, Randall told him uneasily. I wouldn't do that, man. The chief shook his head mournfully. Your station is in the engine room. Duncan dismissed him brusquely, nodded to Randall to order resumption of sailing, and went out to his customary place on the open wing of the bridge. He looked back over the high round stern as the white turbulence of the great propeller boiled out from under the counter, and then settled in a long, slick wake that soon reached back to the horizon. Duncan stood out in the wind until after dark, and when he went below, Chantel was waiting for him. She stood up from the long couch under the forward windows of the stateroom. "We're underway again." "Yes," he said. "It's going to be all right." The engine control was switched to automatic at 9 o'clock local time that night. The engine room personnel went up to dinner and to bed, all except the chief engineer. He lingered for another 2 hours, shaking his head and mumbling bitterly over the massive bearing assembly in the long, narrow shaft tunnel. Every few minutes, he laid his hand on the massive casting, feeling for the heat and vibration that would warn of structural damage. At 11 o'clock, he spat on the steadily revolving propeller shaft. It was thick as an oak trunk and polished brilliant silver in the stark white lights of the tunnel. He pushed himself up stiffly from his crouch beside the bearing. In the control room, he checked again that all the ship's systems were on automatic, and that all circuits were functioning and repeating in the big control board. Then he stepped into the elevator and went up. 35 minutes later, one of the tiny transistors in the board blew with a pop like a champagne cork and a puff of grey smoke. There was nobody in the control room to hear or see it. The system was not duplicated. There was no backup to switch itself in automatically, so that when the temperature of the bearing began to rise, there was no impulse carried to the alarm system, no automatic shutdown of power. The massive shaft spun on while the overheated bearing closed its grip upon the area of rough metal, damaged by the previous prolonged running. A fine sliver of metal lifted from the polished surface of the spinning shaft and curled like a silver hairspring, was caught up and smeared into the bearing. The whole assembly began to glow a sullen cherry red, and then the oxide paint that was daubed on the outer surface of the bearing began to blister and blacken. Still, the tremendous power of the engine forced the shaft around. What oil was still being fed between the glowing surfaces of the spinning shaft and the shells of the bearing turned instantly thin as water in the heat, then reached its flash point and burst into flame, and ran in little fiery rivulets down the heavy casting of the main bearing, flashing the blistered paintwork alight. The shaft tunnel filled with thick billows of stinking, chemical-tainted smoke, and only then did the fire sensors come to life, and their alarms repeated on the navigation bridge and in the quarters of Master, First Officer, and Chief Engineer. But the great engine was still pounding along at 70% of power, and the shaft still turned in the disintegrating bearing, smearing heat-softened metal, buckling and distorting under unbearable strains. The Chief Engineer was the first to reach the central console in the engine control room. Without orders from the bridge, he began emergency shutdowns of all systems. It was another hour before the team, under the direction of the first officer, had the fire in the shaft tunnel under control. They used carbon dioxide gas to smother the burning paint and oil, for cold water on the heated metal would have aggravated the damage done by heat distortion and buckling. The metal of the main bearing casting was still so hot when the chief engineer began opening it up that it scorched the thick leather and asbestos gloves worn by his team. The bearing shells had disintegrated, and the shaft itself was brutally scored and pitted. If there was distortion, the chief knew it would not be detected by eye. However, even a buckling of 1/10,000 of an inch would be critical. He cursed softly as he worked, making the obscenities sound like a lullaby. He cursed the manufacturers of the lubricating pump, the men who'd installed and tested it, the damaged gland and the lack of a backup system. But mostly, he cursed the stubbornness and intractability of the chairman of Christie Marine, whose ill-advised judgment had turned this functionally beautiful machinery into blackened, smoking, twisted metal. It was mid-morning by the time the chief had the spare bearing shells brought up from stores and unpacked from their wood shavings in the wooden cases. It was only when they came to fit them that they realized that the cases had been incorrectly stenciled. The half-shells they contained were obsolete non-metric types, and they were 5 millimeters undersized for Golden Dawn shaft. That tiny variation in size made them utterly useless. It was only then that Duncan Alexander's steely, urbane control began to crack. He raged about the bridge for 20 minutes, making no effort to think his way out of the predicament, but abusing Randall and his engineer in wild and extravagant terms. His rage had a paralyzing effect on all Golden Dawn's officers, and they stood white-faced and silently guilty. Peter Berg had sensed the excitement and slipped up unobtrusively to watch. He was fascinated by his stepfather's rage. He had never seen a display of like it before, and at one stage he hoped that Duncan Alexander's eyeballs might actually burst like overripe grapes. He held his breath in anticipation and felt cheated when it did not happen. At last Duncan stopped and ran both hands through his thick, waving hair. Two spikes of hair stood up like devil's horns. He was still panting, but he'd recovered partial control. "Now, sir, what do you propose?" he demanded of Randall. And in the silence, Peter Berg piped up, "You could have new shells sent from Bermuda. It's only 300 miles away. We checked it this morning." "How did you get in here?" Duncan swung round. "Get back to your mother." Peter scampered, appalled at his own indiscretion, and only when he left the bridge did the chief speak. "We could have spares flown out from London to Bermuda." "There must be a boat," Randall cut in swiftly, "or an aircraft to drop it to us, or a helicopter." "Get Christie Main on the telex," snapped Duncan Alexander. It was good to have a deck under his feet again, Nicholas exulted. He felt himself coming fully alive again. "I'm a sea creature," he grinned to himself, "and I keep forgetting it." He looked back to the low silhouette of the Bermuda Islands, the receding arms of Hamilton Harbour, and the flecking of the multicoloured buildings amongst the cedar trees. And then returned his attention to the spread charts on the navigation table before him. Warlock was still at cautionary speed. Even though the channel was wide and clearly buoyed, yet the coral reef on each hand was sharp and hungry, and David Allen's full attention was on the business of conning Warlock out into the open sea. But as they passed the 100-fathom line, he gave the order to his deck officer, "Full away at 09 hours, pilot," and hurried across to join Nicholas. "I didn't have much chance to welcome you on board, sir." "Thank you, David. It's good to be back." Nicholas looked up and smiled at him. "Will you bring her round on 240 degrees magnetic and increase to 80% power?" Quickly, David repeated his order to the helm, and then shifted from one foot to the other, beginning to flush under the salt-water tan. "Mr. Berg, my officers are driving me mad. They've been plaguing me since we left Cape Town. Are we running on a job, or is this a pleasure cruise?" Nicholas laughed aloud then. He felt the excitement of the hunt, a good hot scent in the nostrils, and the prospect of a fat prize. Now he had Warlock under him. His concern for Peter's safety had abated. Whatever happened now, he would get there very fast. No, he felt good. Very good. "We're hunting David," he told him. "Nothing certain yet." He paused and then relented. "Get Beauty Baker up to my cabin. Tell Angel to send up a big pot of coffee and a mess of sandwiches. I miss breakfast, and while we're eating, I'll fill both of you in." Beauty Baker accepted one of Nicholas's cheroots. "Still smoking cheap," he observed, and sniffed at the $4 cheroot sourly. But there was a twinkle of pleasure behind the smeared lenses of his spectacles. Then, unable to contain himself, he actually grinned. "Skipper tells me we're hunting. Is that right?" This is the picture. Nicholas began to spell it out to them in detail, and while he talked, he thought with comfortable self-indulgence, "I must be getting old and soft. I didn't always talk so much." Both men listened in silence, and only when he finished did the two of them begin bombarding him with the perceptive, penetrating questions he'd expected. "Sounds like a generator armature," Beauty Baker guessed, as he puzzled the contents of the wooden case that had been flown out to Golden Dawn. "I cannot believe that Golden Dawn doesn't carry a full set of mechanical spares." While Baker was fully preoccupied with the mechanics of the situation, David Allen concentrated on the problems of seamanship. "What was the range of the helicopter? Has it returned to base yet? With her draft, she must be heading for the Florida Straits. Our best bet would be to shape a course for Mantanilia Reef at the mouth of the Straits." There was a peremptory knock on the door of the guest cabin, and the trog stuck his grey, wrinkled tortoise head through. He glanced at Nicholas, but did not greet him. "Captain, Miami is broadcasting a new hurricane alert. Lorna has kicked northwards. They're predicting a track of north-northwest and a speed over the ground of 20 knots. He closed the door, and they stared at each other in silence for a moment. Nicholas spoke at last. "It is never one single mistake that causes disaster," he said. "It's always a series of contributory errors. Most of them of small consequence in themselves, but when taken with a little bad luck..." He was silent for a moment, and then softly, "Hurricane Lorna could just be that bit of bad luck." He stood up and took one turn around the small guest cabin, feeling caged, and wishing for the space of the master's suite, which was now David Allen's. He turned back to Beauty Baker and David Allen, and suddenly he realized that they were hoping for disaster. They were like two old sea wolves with the scent of the prey in their nostrils. He felt his anger rising coldly against them. They were wishing disaster on his son. "Just one thing I didn't tell you," he said. "My son is on Golden Dawn." The immense revolving storm that was codenamed Lorna was nearing full development. Her crest was reared high above the freezing levels, so she wore a splendid mane of frosted white ice particles that streamed out 300 miles ahead of her on the jet stream of the upper troposphere. From one side to the other, she now measured 150 miles across, and the power unleashed within her was of unmeasurable savagery. The winds that blew around her centre tore the surface off the sea and bore it aloft at speeds in excess of 150 miles an hour, generating precipitation that was as far beyond rain as death is beyond life. Water filled the dense cloud banks, so there was no clear line between sea and air. It seemed now that madness fed upon madness, and like a blinded berserk monster, she blundered across the confined waters of the Caribbean, ripping the trees and buildings, even the very earth, from the tiny islands which stood in her path. But there were still forces controlling what seemed uncontrollable, dictating what seemed to be random, for, as she spun upon a spinning globe, the storm showed the primary tray of gyroscopic inertia, a rigidity in space that was constant as long as no outside force was applied. Obeying this natural law, the entire system moved steadily eastwards at constant speed and altitude above the surface of the Earth, until her northern edge touched the landmass of the long ridge of land that forms the Greater Antilles. Immediately, another gyroscopic law came into force, the law of precession. When a deflecting force is applied to the rim of a spinning gyro, the gyro moves not away from, but directly towards that force. Hurricane Lorna felt the land, and like a maddened bull at the flirt of the Matador's Cape, she turned and charged towards it, crossing the narrow high strips of Haiti in an orgy of destruction and terror, until she burst out of the narrow channel of the Windward Passage into the open beyond. Yet still she kept on spinning and moving, now barely 300 miles ahead of her, across those shallow reefs and banks, prophetically named Hurricane Flats, after the thousands of other such storms that had followed the same route during the memory of man, lay the deeper waters of the Florida Straits and the mainland of the continental United States of America. At 20 miles an hour, the whole incredible heaven-high mass of crazed wind and churning clouds trundled northwestwards. Duncan Alexander stood under the bogus Degas ballet dancers in the owner's stateroom. He balanced easily on the balls of his feet, and his hands were clasped lightly behind his back. But his brow was heavily furrowed with worry, and his eyes darkly underscored with plum-coloured swollen bags of sleeplessness. Seated on the long couch, and on the imitation Louis XIV chairs flanking the fireplace, were the senior officers of Golden Dawn. Her captain, mate, and chief engineer. And in the leather-studded wing-back chair across the wide cabin sat Charles Gras, the engineer from Atlantique. It seemed as though he had chosen his seat to keep himself aloof from the owner and officers of the crippled ultra-tanker. He spoke now in heavily accented English, falling back on the occasional French word, which Duncan translated quickly. The four men listened to him with complete attention, never taking their eyes from the sharp, pale Parisian features and the foxy bright eyes. "My men will have completed the reassembly of the main bearing by noon today. To the best of my ability, I have examined and tested the main shaft. I can find no evidence of structural damage, but I must emphasize that this does not mean that no damage exists. As a very best, the repairs must be considered to be temporary." He paused, and they waited, while he turned deliberately to Captain Randall. "I must urge you to seek proper repair in the nearest port open to you, and to proceed there at the lowest speed which will enable you efficiently to work the ship." Randall twisted uncomfortably in his seat and glanced across at Duncan. The Frenchman saw the exchange, and a little steel came into his voice. "If there is structural distortion in the main shaft, operation at speeds higher than this may result in permanent and irreversible damage and complete breakdown. I must make this point most forcibly." Duncan intervened smoothly. "We are fully burdened and drawing 20 fathoms of water. There are no safe harbors on the eastern seaboard of America. That is, even supposing that we could get permission to enter territorial waters with engine trouble. The Americans aren't likely to welcome us. Our nearest safe anchorage is Galveston Roads, on the Texas coast of the Gulf of Mexico. And then, only after the tugs have taken off our pod tanks outside the 100-fathom line." The tanker's first officer was a young man, possibly not over 30 years of age. But he had so far conducted himself impeccably in the emergencies the ship had encountered. He had a firm jaw and a clear, level eye, and he had been the first into the smoke-filled shaft tunnel. "With respect, sir." And they all turned their heads towards him. "Miami has broadcast a revised hurricane alert that includes the Straits and southern Florida. We would be on a reciprocal course to the hurricane track, a directly converging course. Even at 15 knots, we would be through the Straits and into the Gulf with 24 hours to spare," Duncan stated, and looked to Randall for confirmation. "At the present speed of the storm's advance, yes," Randall qualified carefully, "but conditions may change." The mate persisted. "Again, with respect, sir, our nearest safe anchorage is in the lee of Bermuda Island." "Do you have any idea of the value of this cargo?" Duncan's voice rasped. "No, you do not. Well, I will inform you. It is $85 million. The interest on that amount is in the region of $25,000 a day." His voice rose a note. Again, the wild note to it. "Bermuda does not have the facilities to effect major repairs." The door from the private accommodation opened silently, and Chantel Alexander stepped into the stateroom. She wore no jewelry, a plain pearl silk blouse, and a simple dark woolen skirt. But her skin had been gilded by the sun, and she had lightly touched her dark eyes with a makeup that emphasized their size and shape. Her beauty silenced them all, and she was fully aware of it as she crossed to stand beside Duncan. "It is necessary that this ship and her cargo proceed directly to Galveston," she said softly. "There is no question about the destination and the route that is to be taken." Charles Gras looked to Captain Randall, waiting for him to assert the authority vested in him by law. But when the young captain remained silent, the Frenchman smiled sardonically and shrugged a world-weary dismissal of further interest. "Then I must ask that arrangements be made for my two assistants and myself to leave this ship immediately. We have completed the temporary repairs." Again, Gras emphasized the word temporary. Duncan nodded. "If we resume our sailing when you anticipate, and even taking into consideration the low fuel condition of the helicopter, we will be within easy range of the east coast of Florida by dawn tomorrow." Chantel had not taken her eyes from Golden Dawn's officers during this exchange, and now she went on in the same quiet voice. "I am quite prepared to accept the resignation of any of the officers of this ship who wish to join that flight." Duncan opened his mouth to make some protest at her assumption of his authority, but she turned to him with a small lift of the chin, and something in her expression and the set of her head upon her shoulders reminded him forcibly of old Arthur Christie. There was the same toughness and resilience there, the same granite determination. Strange that he had not noticed it before. "Perhaps I've never looked before," he thought. Chantel recognized the moment of his capitulation, and calmly she turned back to face Golden Dawn's officers. One by one, they dropped their eyes from hers. Randall was the first to stand up. "If you will excuse me, Mrs. Alexander, I must make preparations to get underway again." Chalgras paused and looked back at her, and he smiled again, as only a Frenchman smiles at a pretty woman. Magnifique, he murmured, and lifted one hand in a graceful salute of admiration before he stepped out of the stateroom. When Chantel and Duncan were alone together, she turned to him slowly, and she let the contempt show in her expression. Any time you feel you've not got the guts for it, let me know, will you? Chantel, you've got us into this, me and Christy Marine. Now you'll get us out of it, even if it kills you. Her lips compressed into a thinner line, and her eyes slitted vindictively. And it would be nice if it did, she said softly. The pilot of the Beechcraft Baron pulled back the throttles to 22 degrees of boost of both engines and slid the propellers into fully fine pitch, simultaneously beginning a gentle descending turn towards the extraordinary-looking vessel that came up swiftly out of the low early morning haze that spilled over from the islands. The same haze had blotted the low silhouette of the Florida coast from the western horizon, and even the pale green water had shaded reefs of Little Bahama's bank were washed pale by the haze, and partially obscured by the intermittent layer of stratocumulus cloud at 4,000 feet. The Baron pilot selected 20 degrees of flap to give the aircraft a nose-down attitude, which would afford a better forward vision, and continued his descent down through the cloud. It burst in a brief grey puff across the windshield before they were out into sunlight again. "What do you make of her?" he asked his co-pilot. "She is a big baby," the co-pilot tried to steady his binoculars. "Can't read her name." The enormously wide, low bows were pushing up a fat, sparkling pillow of churning water, and the green decks seemed to reach back almost to the limits of visibility before rising sheer into the stern quarters. "Son of a gun," the pilot shook his head. "She looks like the vehicle assembly building on Cape Kennedy." "She does, too," agreed his co-pilot. The same square, unlovely bulk of that enormous structure was repeated in smaller scale by the navigation bridge of the big ship. "I'll give her a call on 16. The co-pilot lowered his binoculars and thumbed the microphone as he lifted it to his lips. "Southbound bulk carrier. This is Coast Guard November Charlie 1 Pfeiffer Niner overhead. Do you read me?" There was the expected delay. Even in confined and heavily trafficked waters, these big bastards kept a sloppy watch, and the spotter fumed silently. "Coast Guard 159er, this is Golden Dawn, reading you Fife by Fife, going up to 22. 200 miles away, the trog knocked over the shell casing, spilling damp and stinking cigar butts over the deck, in his haste to change frequency to Channel 22, as the operator on board Golden Dawn had stipulated. At the same time, switching in both the tape recorder and the radio direction finder equipment. High up in Warlock's fire control tower, the big metal ring of the direction finding aerial turned slowly, lining up on the transmissions that boomed so clearly across the ether, repeating the relative bearing on the dial of the instrument on Trog's cluttered bench. "Good morning to you, Golden Dawn." The lilting southern twang of the Coast Guard navigator came back. "I would be mightily obliged for your port of registry and your cargo manifest." "This ship is registered Venezuela." The Trog dexterously made the fine-tuning, scribbled the bearing on his pad, ripped off the page, and darted into Warlock's navigation bridge. "Golden Dawn is sending in clear," he squeaked with an expression of malicious glee. Call the captain, snapped the deck officer, and then as an afterthought, and ask Mr. Berg to come to the bridge. The conversation between Coast Guard and Ultra Tanker was still going on when Nicholas burst into the radio room, belting his dressing gown. Thank you for your courtesy, sir. The Coast Guard navigator was using extravagant southern gallantry, fully aware that Golden Dawn was outside United States territorial waters and officially beyond his government's jurisdiction. I would appreciate your port of final destination. We are en route, Galveston, for full discharge of cargo. Thank you again, sir. And are you apprised of the hurricane alert in force at this time? Affirmative. From Warlock's Bridge, David Allen appeared in the doorway, his face set and flushed. She must be underway again, he said, his disappointment so plain that it angered Nicholas yet again. She is into the channel already. I'd be obliged if you would immediately put this ship on a course to enter the straits and close with her as soon as is possible, Nicholas snapped. And David Allen blinked at him once, then disappeared onto his bridge, calling for the change in course and increase in speed as he went. Over the loudspeaker, the Coast Guard was being politely persistent. Are you further apprised, sir, of the update on that hurricane alert predicting storm passage of the main navigable channel at 1200 hours local time tomorrow? Affirmative. Golden Dawn's replies have become curt. May I further trouble you, sir, in view of your sensitive cargo and the special weather conditions, for your expected time of arrival abeam the Dry Tortugas Bank Marine Beacon, and when you anticipate clearing the channel and shaping a northerly course away from the predicted hurricane track? Stand by. There was a brief hum of static while the operator consulted the deck officer, and then the Golden Dawn came back. Our ETA, Dry Tortugas Bank Beacon, is 0130 tomorrow. There was a long pause now, as the Coast Guard consulted his headquarters ashore on one of the closed frequencies. And then, I am requested respectfully, but officially, to bring to your attention that very heavy weather is expected ahead of the storm center, and that your present ETA Dry Tortugas Bank leaves you very fine margins of safety, sir. Thank you, Coast Guard 159er. Your transmission will be entered in the ship's log. This is Golden Dawn, over and out. The Coast Guard's frustration was evident. Clearly, he would have loved to order the tanker to reverse her course. We will be following your progress with interest, Golden Dawn. Bon voyage. This is Coast Guard 159er, over and out. Charles Gras held his blue beret in one hand, while with the other he lugged his suitcase. He ran doubled up, instinctively avoiding the ear-numbing clatter of the helicopter's rotor. He threw his suitcase through the open fuselage door, and then hesitated, turned, and scampered back to where the ship's chief engineer stood on the edge of the white-painted helipad target on Golden Dawn's tank deck. Charles grabbed the engineer's upper arm and leaned close to shout in his ear, "Remember, my friend, treat her like a baby, like a tender virgin. If you have to increase speed, do so gently. Very gently." The engineer nodded, his sparse sandy hair fluttering in the downdraft. "Good luck," shouted the Frenchman. "Bonne chance." He slapped the man's shoulder. "I hope you don't need it." He darted back and scrambled up into the fuselage of the Sikorsky, and his face appeared in one of the portholes. He waved once, and then the big, ungainly machine rose slowly into the air, hovered for a moment, and then banked away low over the water, setting off in its characteristic nose-down attitude for the mainland, still hidden by haze and distance. Dr. Samantha Silver, dressed in thigh-high rubber waders, and with her sleeves rolled up above the elbows, staggered under the weight of 2 10-gallon plastic buckets of clams as she climbed the back steps of the laboratory building. "Sam!" Down the length of the long passageway, Sally Ann screamed at her. "We were going to leave without you." "What is it?" Sam dumped the buckets with relief, slopping salt water down the steps. "Johnny called. The anti-pollution patrol bespoke Golden Dawn an hour ago. She's in the Straits. She was abeam Matanilla Reef when they spotted her, and she'll be abeam of Biscayne Bay before we can get out there, if we don't leave now." "I'm coming." Sam hefted her heavy buckets and broke into a rubber-kneed trot. "I'll meet you down on the wharf. Did you call the TV studio?" "There's a camera team on the way," Sally Ann yelled back as she ran for the front doors. "Hurry, Sam, fast as you like." Samantha damped the clams into one of the tanks, switched on the oxygen, and as soon as it began to bubble to the surface, she turned and raced from the laboratory and out of the front doors. Golden Dawn's deck officer stopped beside the radar scope, glanced down at it idly, then stooped with more attention and took a bearing on the little glowing pinpoint of green light that showed up clearly inside the 10-mile circle of the sweep. He grunted, straightened, and walked quickly to the front of the bridge. Slowly, he scanned the green, wind-chopped sea ahead of the tanker's ponderous bows. "Fishing boat," he said to the helmsman. "But they're underway." He had seen the tiny flash of a bow wave. "And they're right in the main navigational channel. They must have seen us by now. They're making a turn to pass us to starboard." He dropped the monoculars and let them dangle against his chest. "Oh, thank you." He took the cup of cocoa from the steward and sipped it with relish as he turned away to the chart table. One of the tanker's junior officers came out of the radio room at the back of the bridge. "Still no score," he said, "and only injury time left now." And they fell into a concerned discussion of the World Cup soccer match being played under floodlights at Wembley Stadium on the other side of the Atlantic. "If it's a draw, then it means that France is in the..." There was an excited shout from the radio room, and the junior officer ran to the door and then turned back with an excited grin. "England has scored!" The deck officer chuckled happily. "That will wrap it up." Then, with a start of guilt, he turned back to his duties and had another start, this time of surprise, when he glanced into the radar scope. "What the hell are they playing at?" he exclaimed irritably, and hurried forward to scan the sea ahead. The fishing boat had continued its turn and was now bows on. "Damn them. We'll give them a buzz." He reached up for the handle of the foghorn and blew 3 long blasts that echoed out mournfully across the shallow greenish water of the straits. There was a general movement among the officers to get a better view ahead through the forward bridge windows. "They must be half asleep out there." The deck officer thought quickly about calling the captain to the bridge. If it came to manoeuvring the ship in these confined waters, he flinched from the responsibility. Even at this reduced speed, it would take Golden Dawn 30 minutes and 7 nautical miles to come to a stop. A turn in either direction would swing through a wide arc of many miles before the ship was able to make a 90-degree change of course. God. Then there was the effect of the wind against the enormously exposed area of the towering stern quarters, and the full bore of the Gulf Stream driving out of the narrows of the straits. The problems of manoeuvring the vessel struck a chill of panic into the officer. And the fishing boat was on collision course, the range closing swiftly under the combined speeds of both vessels. He reached for the call button of the intercom that connected the bridge directly to the captain's quarters on the deck below. At that moment, Captain Randall came bounding up the private staircase from his day cabin. "What is it?" he demanded. "What was that blast on the horn?" "Small vessel holding to a collision course, sir." The officer's relief was evident, and Randall seized the handle of the foghorn and hung on to it. "God, what's wrong with them?" "The deck is crowded," exclaimed one of the officers without lowering his binoculars. "Looks as though they have a movie camera team on the top deck." Randall judged the closing range anxiously. Already, the small fishing vessel was too close for the Golden Dawn to stop in time. "Thank God," somebody exclaimed. "They're turning away. They're streaming some sort of banner. Can anybody read it?" "They're heaving to," the deck officer yelled suddenly. "They're heaving to right under our bows." Samantha Silver had not expected the tanker to be so big. From directly ahead, her bows seemed to fill the horizon from one side to the other. And the bow wave she threw up ahead of her, creamed and curved, like the set of the long wave of Cape St. Francis when the surf was up. Beyond the bows, the massive tower of her navigation bridge stood so tall it looked like the skyline of the Miami Beach, one of those massive hotel buildings seen from close inshore. It made her feel distinctly uneasy to be directly under that onrushing steel avalanche. "Do you think they've seen us?" Sally Ann asked beside her. And when Samantha heard her own unease echoed by the pretty girl beside her, it steeled her. "Of course they have," she announced stoutly, so that everyone in the small wheelhouse could hear her. "That's why they blew their siren. We'll turn aside at the last minute." "They're slowing down," Hank Peterson, the helmsman, pointed out huskily, and Samantha wished that Tom Parker had been on board with them. However, Tom was up in Washington again, and they had taken the dicky to sea with a scratch crew and without Tom Parker's written authorization. "What do you want to do, sir?" They all looked at her. "I know a thing that size can't stop, but at least we're going to make them slow down." "Are the TV boys getting some stuff?" Samantha asked, to delay the moment of decision. "Go up, Sally Ann, and check them." Then to the others. "You all get the banner ready. We'll let them get a good look at that." "Listen, sir." Hank Peterson's tanned, intelligent face was strained. He was a tunny expert, and was not accustomed to handling the vessel except in calm and uncluttered waters. "I don't like this. We're getting much too close. That thing could churn us right under and not even notice the bump. I want to turn away now." His voice was almost drowned by the sudden sky-crashing blast of the tanker's foghorns. "Son of a gun, Sam. I don't like playing chicken-chicken with somebody that size." "Don't worry. We'll get out of their way at the last moment." "All right," Samantha decided. "Turn 90 degrees to port, Hank. Let's show them the signs. I'm going to help them on the deck." The wind tore at the thin white canvas banner as they tried to run it out along the side of the deckhouse, and the little vessel was rolling uncomfortably while the TV producer was shouting confused stage directions at them from the top of the wheelhouse. Bitterly, Samantha wished there was somebody to take command, somebody like Nicholas Berg, and the banner tried to wrap itself around her head. The dicky was coming around fast now, and Samantha shot a glance at the oncoming tanker and felt the shock of it strike in the pit of her stomach like the blow of a fist. It was huge and very close, much too close, even she realized that. At last, she managed to get a turn of the thin line that secured the banner around the stern rail. but the light canvas had twisted so that only one word of the slogan was readable. Poisoner, it accused in scarlet. Crudely painted letters followed by a grinning skull and crossed bones. Samantha dived across the deck and struggled with the flapping canvas. Above her head, the producer was shouting excitedly. Two of the others were trying to help her. Sally Ann was screaming, "Go back! Go back!" and waving both arms at the great tanker. "You poison our oceans!" Everything was becoming confused and out of control. The dickey swung ahead into the wind and pitched steeply. The person next to her lost his footing and knocked painfully into Samantha. At that moment, she felt the change of the engine beat. Tricky Dicky's diesel had been bellowing furiously as Hank opened the throttle to its stop, using full power to bring the little vessel round from under the menace of those steel bows. The smoking splutter of the exhaust pipe that rose vertically up the side of the dockhouse had made all speech difficult. But now it died away, and suddenly there was only the sound of the wind. Even their own raised voices were silenced, and they froze, staring out as golden dawn as she bore down on them without the slightest check in her majestic approach. Samantha was the first to recover. Then she ran across the plunging deck to the wheelhouse. Hank Peterson was down on his knees beside the bulkhead, struggling ineffectually with the conduit that housed the controls to the engine room on the deck below. "Why have you stopped?" Samantha yelled at him, and he looked up at her as though he were mortally wounded. "It's the throttle linkage," he said. "It snapped again." "Can't you fix it?" And the question was mockery. A mile away, Golden Dawn came down on them, silent, menacing, unstoppable. For 10 seconds, Randall stood rigid, both hands gripping the foul weather rail below the sill of the bridge windows. His face was set, pale and finely drawn, as he watched the stern of the wallowing fishing boat for the renewed churning of its prop. He knew that he could not turn nor stop his ship in time to avoid collision, unless the small vessel got underway immediately and took evasive action by going out to starboard under full power. "Damn them to hell," he thought bitterly. They were in gross default. He had all the law and the custom of the sea behind him. A collision would cause very little damage to Golden Dawn. Perhaps she would lose a little paint, at most a slightly buckled plate in the reinforced bows. And they had asked for it. He had no doubts about the object of this crazy, irresponsible seamanship. There had been enough controversy before Golden Dawn sailed. He had read the objections and seen the nutcase environmentalists on television. The scarlet-painted banner with the ridiculously melodramatic Jolly Roger made it clear that this was a boatload of nutters attempting to prevent Golden Dawn entering American waters. He felt his anger boiling up fiercely. These people always made him furious. If they had their way, there would be no tanker trade. And now they were deliberately threatening him, placing him in a position which might prejudice his own career. He already had the task of taking his ship through the straits ahead of the hurricane. Every moment was vital. And now there was this. He would be happy to maintain course and speed and run them down. They were flaunting themselves, challenging him to do it, and by God, they deserved it. However, he was a seaman, with a seaman's deep concern for human life at sea. It would go against all his instincts not to make an effort to avoid collision, no matter how futile that effort would be. Then, beside him, one of his officers triggered him. "There are women on board. Look at that. Those are women." That was enough. Without waiting for confirmation, Randall snapped at the helmsman beside him, "Full port rudder." And with two swift paces, he had reached the engine room telegraph. It rang shrilly as he pulled back the chromed handle to full astern. Almost immediately, the changed beat came up through the soles of his feet as the great engine 7 decks below the bridge thundered suddenly under all emergency power, and the direction of the spinning main propeller shaft was abruptly reversed. Randall spun back to face ahead. For almost 5 minutes, the bows held steady on the horizon without making any answer to the full application of the rudder. The inertia of 1 million tons of crude oil, the immense drag on the hull through water, and the press of wind and current held her on course. And though the single ferro-bronze propeller bit deeply into the green waters, there was not the slightest diminution of the tanker's speed. Randall kept his hand on the engine telegraph, pulling back on the silver handle with all his strength, as though this might arrest the great ship's forward way through the water. "Turn," he whispered to the ship, and he stared at the fishing boat that still lay, rolling wildly, directly in Golden Dawn's path. He noticed irrelevantly that the tiny human figures along the rear rail were waving frantically, and that the banner, with its scarlet denunciation, had torn loose at one end, and was now whipping and twisting like a Tibetan prayer flag over the heads of the crew. "Turn," Randall whispered, and he saw the first response of the hull. The angle between the bows and the fishing boat altered. It was a noticeable change, but slowly accelerating, and a quick glance at the control console showed a small check in the ship's forward speed. "Turn, damn it, turn!" Randall held the engine telegraph locked at full astern, and felt the sudden influence of the Gulf Stream current on the ship as she began to come across the direction of flow. Ahead, the fishing boat was almost about to disappear from sight behind Golden Dawn's high, blunt bows. He had been holding the ship at full astern for almost 7 minutes now, and suddenly Randall felt a change in Golden Dawn, something he had never experienced before. There was harsh, tearing, pounding vibration coming up through the deck. He realized just how severe that vibration must be when Golden Dawn's monumental hull began to shake violently. But he could not release his grip on the engine telegraph, not with that helpless vessel lying in his track. Then suddenly, miraculously, all vibration in the deck under his feet ceased altogether. There was only the calm press of the hull through the water. No longer the feel of the engine's thrust, a sensation much more alarming to a mariner than the vibration which had preceded it. And simultaneously, a fiery rash of red warning lights bloomed on the ship's main control console, and the strident screech of the full emergency audio alarm deafened them all. Only then did Captain Randall push the engine telegraph to stop. He stood staring ahead as the tiny fishing boat disappeared from view, hidden by the angle from the navigation bridge, which was 1 mile behind the bows. One of the officers reached across and hit the cutout on the audio alarm. In the sudden silence, every officer stood frozen, waiting for the impact of collision. Golden Dawn's chief engineer paced slowly along the engine room control console, never taking his eyes from the electronic displays which monitored all the ship's mechanical and electrical functions. When he reached the alarm board, he stopped and frowned at it angrily. The failure of the single transistor, a few dollars' worth of equipment, had been the cause of such brutal damage to his beloved machinery. He leaned across and pressed the test button, checking out each alarm circuit. Yet, while he was doing it, recognizing the fact that it was too late. He was nursing the ship along, with God alone knew what undiscovered damage to engine and main shaft, only kept in check by this reduced power setting. And there was a hurricane down there, below the southern horizon. And the chief could only guess at what emergency his machinery might have to meet in the next few days. It made him nervous and edgy to think about it. He searched in his back pocket, found a sticky mint humbug, carefully picked off the little pieces of lint and fluff before tucking it into his cheek like a squirrel with a nut, sucking noisily upon it as he resumed his restless prowling up and down the control console. His on-duty stokers and oilers watched him surreptitiously. When the old man was in a mood, it was best not to attract attention. "Dixon," the chief said suddenly, "get your lid on. We're going down the shaft tunnel again." The oiler sighed, exchanged a resigned glance with one of his mates, and clapped his hard hat on his head. He and the chief had been down the tunnel an hour previously. It was an uncomfortable, noisy, and dirty journey. The oiler closed the watertight doors into the shaft tunnel behind them, screwing down the clamps firmly under the chief's frosty scrutiny. And then both men stooped in the confined headroom and started off along the brightly lit, pale grey painted tunnel. The spinning shaft, in its deep bed, generated a high-pitched whine that seemed to resonate in the steel box of the tunnel, as though it was the body of a violin. Surprisingly, the noise was more pronounced at this low speed setting. It seemed to bore into the teeth at the back of the oiler's jaw like a dentist's drill. The chief did not seem to be affected. He paused beside the main bearing for almost 10 minutes, testing it with the palm of his hand, feeling for heat or vibration. His expression was morose, and he worried the mint humbug in his cheek and shook his head with foreboding before going on up the tunnel. When he reached the main gland, he squatted down suddenly and peered at it closely. With a deliberate flexing of his jaw, he crushed the remains of the humbug between his teeth, and his eyes narrowed thoughtfully. There was a thin trickle of seawater oozing from the gland and running down into the bilges. The chief touched it with his finger. Something had shifted. Some balance was disturbed. The seal of the gland was no longer watertight. Such a small sign, a few gallons of seawater, could be the first warning of major structural damage. The chief shuffled around, still hunched down beside the shaft bed, and he lowered his face until it was only inches from the spinning steel main shaft. He closed one eye and cocked his head, trying once again to decide if the faint blurring of the shaft's outline was real or merely his overactive imagination, whether what he was seeing was distortion or his own fears. Suddenly, startlingly, the shaft slammed into stillness. The deceleration was so abrupt that the chief could actually see the toque transferred into the shaft bed, and the metal walls creaked and popped with the strain. He rocked back on his heels, and almost instantly the shaft began to spin again, but this time in reverse thrust. The whine built up swiftly into a rising shriek. They were pulling emergency power from the bridge, and it was madness, suicidal madness. The chief seized the oiler by the shoulder and shouted into his ear, "Get back to control! Find out what the hell they're doing on the bridge!" The oiler scrambled away down the tunnel. It took him 10 minutes to negotiate the long, narrow passage, open the watertight doors, and reach the control room, and as long again to return. The chief considered going after him, but somehow he could not leave the shaft now. He lowered his head again, and now he could see clearly the flickering of the outline of the shaft. It wasn't imagination at all. There was a little ghost of movement. He clamped his hands over his ears to cut out the painful shriek of the spinning metal, and there was a new note to it, the squeal of bare metal on metal. And before his eyes, he saw the ghost outline along the edge of the shaft growing, the flutter of machinery out of balance, and the metal deck under his feet began to quiver. "God, they're going to blow the whole thing!" he shouted, and jumped up from his crouch. Now the deck was juddering and shaking under his feet. He started back along the shaft, but the entire tunnel was agitating so violently that he had to grab at the metal bulkhead to steady himself, and he reeled drunkenly, thrown about like a captive insect in a cruel child's box. Ahead of him, he saw the huge metal casting of the main bearing twisting and shaking, and the vibration chattered his teeth and his clenched jaw and drove up his spine like a jackhammer. Disbelievingly, he saw the huge silver shaft beginning to rise and buckle in its bed, the bearing tearing loose from its mountings. "Shut down!" he screamed. "For God's sake, shut down!" But his voice was lost in the shriek and scream of tortured metal and machinery that was tearing itself to pieces in a suicidal frenzy. The main bearing exploded, and the shaft slammed it into the bulkhead, tearing steel plate like paper. The shaft itself began to snake and whip. The chief cowered back, pressing his back to the bulkhead and covering his ears to protect them from the unbearable volume of noise. A sliver of heated steel flew from the bearing and struck him in the face, laying open his upper lip to the bone, crushing his nose and snapping off his front teeth at the level of the gums. He toppled forward, and the whipping, kicking shaft seized him like a mindless predator and tore his body to pieces, pounding him and crushing him in the shaft bed and splattering him against the pale metal walls. The main shaft snapped like a rotten twig at the point where it had been heated and weakened. The unbalanced weight of the revolving propeller ripped the stump out through the after seal, as though it were a tooth plucked from a rotting jaw. The sea rushed in through the opening, flooding the tunnel instantly until it slammed into the watertight doors, and the huge, glistening bronze propeller, with the stump of the main shaft still attached, the whole unit, weighing 150 tons, plummeted downwards through 400 fathoms to embed itself deeply in the soft mud of the sea bottom. Freed of the intolerable goad of her damaged shaft, Golden Dawn was suddenly silent, and her deck still and steady, as she trundled on, slowly losing way as the water dragged at her hull. Samantha had one awful moment of sickening guilt. She saw clearly that she was responsible for the deadly danger into which she had led these people, and she stared out over the boat's side at the Golden Dawn. The tanker was coming on without any check in her speed. Perhaps she had turned a few degrees, for her bows were no longer pointed directly at them, but her speed was constant. She was achingly aware of her inexperience, of her helplessness in this alien situation. She tried to think, to force herself out of this frozen despondency. "Life jackets," she thought, and yelled to Sally Ann out on the deck, "The life jackets are in the lockers behind the wheelhouse." Their faces turned to her, and suddenly stricken. Up to this moment, it had all been a glorious romp, the old fun game of challenging the money grabbers, prodding the establishment. But now suddenly it was mortal danger. "Move!" Samantha shrieked at them, and there was a rush back along the deck. "Think." Samantha shook her head, as though to clear it. "Think!" she urged herself fiercely. She could hear the tanker now, the silken, rustling sound of the water under its hull, the sough of the bow wave curling upon itself. The dickey's throttle linkage had broken before, when they'd been off Key West a year ago. It had broken between the bridge and the engine, and Samantha had watched Tom Parker fiddling with the engine, holding the lantern for him to see in the gloomy confines of the smelly little engine room. She had not been certain how he did it, but she remembered that he had controlled the revolutions of the engine by hand, something on the side of the engine block, below the big bowl of the air filter. Samantha turned and dived down the vertical ladder into the engine room. The diesel was running, burbling away quietly at idling speed, not generating sufficient power to move the little vessel through the water. She tripped and sprawled on the greasy deck, and pulled herself up, crying out with pain as her hand touched the red-holed manifold of the engine exhaust. On the far side of the engine block, she groped desperately under the air filter, pushing and tugging at anything her fingers touched. She found a coil spring and dropped to her knees to examine it. She tried not to think of the huge steel hull bearing down on them, of being down in this tiny box that stank of diesel and exhaust fumes and old bilges. She tried not to think of not having a life jacket, or that the tanker could tramp the little vessel deep down under the surface and crush her like a matchbox. Instead, she traced the little coil spring to where it was pinned into a flat, upright lever. Desperately, she pushed the lever against the tension of the spring, and instantly the diesel engine bellowed deafeningly in her ears, startling her so that she flinched and lost the lever. The diesel's beat died away into the bumbling idle, and she wasted seconds while she found the lever again and pushed it hard against its stops once more. The engine roared, and she felt the ship picking up speed under her. She began to pray incoherently. She could not hear the words in the engine noise, and she was not sure she was making sense, but she held the throttle open and kept on praying. She did not hear the screams from the deck above her. She did not know how close the Golden Dawn was. She did not know if Hank Peterson was still in the wheelhouse, conning the little vessel out of the path of the onrushing tanker. But she held the throttle open and prayed. The impact, when it came, was shattering. The crash and crackle of timbers breaking, the rending lurch and roll of the deck giving to the tearing force of it. Samantha was hurled against the hot steel of the engine, her forehead striking with such force that her vision starred into blinding white light. She dropped backwards, her body loose and relaxed, darkness ringing in her ears, and lay huddled on the deck. She did not know how long she was unconscious, but it could not have been for more than a few seconds. The spray of icy cold water on her face roused her, and she pulled herself up onto her knees. In the glare of the single bare electric globe in the deck above her, Samantha saw the spurts of water jets through the starting planking of the bulkhead beside her. Her shirt and denim pants were soaked. Salt water half blinded her, and her head felt as though the skull were cracked and someone was forcing the sharp end of a bradawl between her eyes. Dimly, she was aware that the diesel engine was idling noisily, and that the deck was sloshing with water as the boat rolled wildly in some powerful turbulence. She wondered if the whole vessel had been trodden under by the tanker. Then she realized it must be the wake of the giant hull which was throwing them about so mercilessly, but they were still afloat. She began to crawl down the plunging deck. She knew where the bilge pump was. That was one thing Tom had taught all of them, and she crawled on grimly towards it. Hank Peterson ducked out of the wheelhouse, flapping his arms wildly as he struggled into the life jacket. He was not certain of the best action to take, whether to jump over the side and begin swimming away from the tanker's slightly angled course, or to stay on board and take his chances with the collision, which was now only seconds away. Around him, the others were in the grip of the same indecision. They were huddled silently at the rail, staring up at the mountain of smooth, round steel that seemed to blot out half the sky. Only the TV cameraman on the wheelhouse, a true fanatic, oblivious of all danger, kept his camera running. His exclamations of delight and the burr of the camera motor blended with the rushing sibilance of Golden Dawn's bow wave. It was 15 feet high, that wave, and it sounded like wild fire in dry grass. Suddenly, the exhaust of the diesel engine above Hank's head bellowed harshly, and then subsided into a soft, burbling idle again. He looked up at it uncomprehendingly. Now it roared again fiercely, and the deck lurched beneath him. From the stern, he heard the boil of the water driven by the propeller, and the dickey shrugged off her lethargy and lifted her bows to the short, steep wall of the Gulf Stream. A moment later, Hank stood frozen, and then he dived back into the wheelhouse and spun the spokes of the wheel through his fingers, shearing off sharply, but still staring out through the side glass. The Golden Dawn's bows filled his whole vision now, but the smaller vessel was scooting frantically out to one side, and the tanker's bows were swinging majestically in the opposite direction. A few seconds more, and they would be clear. But the bow wave caught them, and Hank was flung across the wheelhouse. He felt something break in his chest, and heard the snap of bone as he hit. Then immediately afterwards, there was the crackling, rending, tearing impact as the two hulls came together, and he was thrown back the other way, sprawling wildly across the deck. He tried to claw himself upright, but the little fishing boat was pitching and cavorting with such abandon that he was thrown flat again. There was another tearing impact as the vessel was dragged down the tanker's side, and then flung free to roll her rails under and bob like a cork in the mill race of the huge ship's wake. Now at last, he was able to pull himself to his feet, and doubled over, clutching his injured ribs, he peered dazedly through the wheelhouse glass. Half a mile away, the tanker was lazily turning up into the wind, and there was no propeller wash from under her counter. Hank staggered to the doorway and looked out. The deck was still awash, but the water they had taken on was pouring out through the scuppers. The railing was smashed, most of it dangling overboard, and the planking was splintered and torn, the ripped timber as white as bone in the sunlight. Behind him, Samantha came crawling up the ladder from the engine room. There was a purple swelling in the center of her forehead. She was soaking wet, and her hands were filthy with black grease. He saw a livid red burn across the back of one hand as she lifted it to brush tumbled blonde hair out of her face. "Are you all right, sir?" "Water's pouring in," she said. "I don't know how long the pump can hold it." "Did you fix the motor?" he asked. Samantha nodded. "I held the throttle open," she said, and then with feeling, "but I'll be damned to hell if I'll do it again. Somebody else can go down there. I've had my turn." "Show me how," Hank said, "and you can take the wheel. The sooner we get back to Key Biscayne, the happier I'll be." Samantha peered across at the receding bulk of Golden Dawn. "My God." She shook her head with wonder. "My God, we were lucky." Mackerel skies and mare's tails make tall ships carry short sails. Nicholas Berg recited the old sailor's doggerel to himself, shading his eyes with one hand as he looked upwards. The cloud was beautiful as fine lacework. Very high against the tall blue of the heavens, it spread swiftly in those long, filmy scrolls. Nicholas could see the patterns developing and expanding as he watched, and that was a measure of the speed with which the high winds were blowing. That cloud was at least 30,000 feet high, and below it the air was clear and crisp. Only out on the western horizon, the billowing silver and blue thunderheads were rising, generated by the landmass of Florida, whose low silhouette was still below their horizon. They had been in the main current of the Gulf Stream for 6 hours now. It was easy to recognize this characteristic send of the sea, the short, steep swells marching close together, the particular brilliance of these waters that had been first warmed in the shallow tropical basin of the Caribbean, the increased bulk flooding through into the Gulf of Mexico, and there heated further, swelling in volume, until they formed a hillock of water, which at last rushed out through this narrow drain hole of the Florida Straits, swinging north and east in a wide, benevolent wash, tempering the climate of all countries whose shores it touched, and warming the fishing grounds of the North Atlantic. In the middle of this stream, somewhere directly ahead of Warlock's thrusting bows, the Golden Dawn was struggling southwards, directly opposed to the current, which would clip 80 miles a day off her speed, and driving directly into the face of one of the most evil and dangerous storms that nature could summon. Nicholas found himself brooding again on the mentality of anyone who would do that. Again, he glanced upwards at the harbingers of the storm, those delicate wisps of lacy cloud. Nicholas had sailed through a hurricane once, 20 years ago, as a junior officer on one of Christie Marine's small grain carriers, and he shuddered now at the memory of it. Duncan Alexander was a desperate man even to contemplate that risk, a man gambling everything on one fall of the dice. Nicholas could understand the forces that drove him, for he had been driven himself, but he hated him now for the chances which he was taking. Duncan Alexander was risking Nicholas's son, and he was risking the life of an ocean and of the millions of people whose existence was tied to that ocean. Duncan Alexander was gambling with stakes that were not his to place at hazard. Nicholas wanted one thing only now, and that was to get alongside Golden Dawn and take off his son. He would do that, even if it meant boarding her like a buccaneer. In the master's suite, there was a locked and sealed arms cupboard with 2 riot guns, automatic 12-gauge shotguns, and 6 Valter PK 38 pistols. Warlock had been equipped for every possible emergency in any ocean of the world, and those emergencies could include piracy or mutiny aboard a vessel under salvage. Now Nicholas was fully prepared to take an armed party on board Golden Dawn, and to take his chances in any court of law afterwards.